Welcome to It's True or Is It? A podcast that mixes fact and fiction, then tries to sort them out again. Your hosts are Michael Pryor and George Ivanov.
Hello and welcome to It's True or Is It? My name is George Ivanov and I'm here today with
Michael Pryor. And George, what's our topic for this episode?
Well, nice broad topic, history.
Oh, I love history. Yeah, I always say that every story ever is in history.
Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, and even stuff that is current will be history in just a short amount of time.
Very true, very true. And, of course, it's the time span that we've got to work with. And we have to choose three stories, two of which are true, one of which is an absolute fake. Mm-hmm. And rummaging through history, yeah, no shortage of stuff.
Oh, yes, indeed. And, yeah, we've got so many different eras to choose from. And it was hard. It was hard narrowing it down.
Very much so. And we've talked about the seduction of research, that once you start researching and finding interesting things, it's hard to stop sometimes.
Oh, yeah, it is very hard to stop. There is that rabbit hole, and once you're down it, it's hard to get back up.
So just to explain to our loyal listeners out there, the procedure we've got here is that we will bounce between each other, presenting our nuggets of information, true and false, but we won't reveal the fake ones until the very end of this episode.
That's right.
Now, George, would you like to go first?
I'm sure. Well, I've got three to choose from. I've got Australian history, French history, or US history. So which would you like me to start with?
I'm flipping a metaphorical three-sided coin here. Let's go American history.
American history. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about Abraham Lincoln, who is, of course, the 16th president of the United States of America. But as well as being a politician, Abraham Lincoln was also a lawyer and a soldier for a time. But did you realise that he was also a pro wrestler?
George, I'm already starting to smell fakery here. But
No. It was in his younger days.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And, you know, he was 6'4", which was quite tall for that time. And he was very athletic. He actually played a lot of sports as a young man. But wrestling was his thing. And he competed in about 300 wrestling matches in his youth.
That's a lot of wrestling
matches. That is a lot of wrestling matches. And his abilities were actually formally recognized by the National Wrestling Hall of Fame, which inducted him as a, quote, outstanding American in the sport in 1992. So it took a while for him to actually be recognised, but he got there in the end. Now, sadly, he wasn't very good at it. So he did have, like, almost around about 300 wrestling matches, of which he apparently lost everyone bar one. And the one that he did not lose took place during the Black Hawk War in 1832. So the Black Hawk War didn't actually last for very long. It was the US versus some Native American Indian tribes, as, you know, happened back then when they were taking their land and all of that sort of stuff. And the wrestling match was between Abe and the champion from another voluntary military unit at the time. So there were two opposing units, and there was, you know, a lot of competition between two of them.
Always
and,
is.
Yeah, and Abe got challenged by this champion from this other unit. He probably thought he was going to get an easy win. Abe didn't exactly have the best of reputations for winning his wrestling matches. And so he probably thought, ha-ha, here's the chance to look good in front of my unit. Mm. And they had their wrestling match, and Abe won.
Yeah. How?
I actually have no idea. The thing is that there isn't a huge amount of information about this, apart from the fact that he did this wrestling.
Strangely, historians have chosen to concentrate more on his political career than his wrestling.
Yeah, who would have thought why? Mm. But, you know, it's not an uncommon thing, apparently, because good old George Washington was also into wrestling, although he, a particular type of wrestling called collar and elbow.
Okay.
And it had to do with trying to get your hand behind the collarbone of someone while having your elbows together or some. I don't know. I read the explanation and made absolutely no sense to me.
These are olden days. Mm. Well, George, so that's it. That's your fact.
That is my fact. Abe Lincoln was an unsuccessful pro wrestler.
A grappler, someone who specialised in the sleeper hold or similar. I'm thinking that, did he have a wrestler name, like Abominable Abe?
No. This was before the days of nom de plumes in wrestling.
And the showmanship wrestling of today.
As far as I understand, wrestling back then was much more straightforward.
Okay. All right, so that's your historical fact number one. Mm-hmm. Could be true, could be false. I have to decide at the end of this episode.
Let me assure you, 100% true.
Well, all right, George. Now, I'll rocket straight into my story, number one, plucked from the pages of the past. Mm-hmm. And mine is sort of British history, but it's got a little bit of continental stuff going on here. And I've chosen to concentrate on a person. This is like a little biography, if you like, of a person from the past. And this is Glenda Pignall, 1902 to 1972. And she had the nickname of the Merry Prankster. She lived in London, and she would often dress up in a bear suit and crash public occasions like balls, parties, and even the Derby race meeting at Epsom Racecourse during her lifetime. That was almost her fallback, her default prank, because she had many, many others. She spent the year of 1930 in France, staying at the most exclusive hotels and paying nothing by telling them that she was the Countess of Sternshire. A totally fictitious title. In 1934, she went on a lecture tour of the UK, telling about how she'd sailed solo across the Atlantic from west to east, only to be captured by pirates off the coast of Spain and sold into slavery. In 1935, she claimed to have invented pignolite, a potential source of unlimited energy. The Royal Society was not impressed by this claim. In 1937, she put a large advertisement in the Times and other papers saying that to save money on the demolition plans for London Bridge, members of the public were invited to bring crowbars and hammers to dismantle it themselves, taking away any stones free of charge. A large crowd showed up on the next day, causing traffic chaos and general pandemonium. The Second World War, however, put an end to her pranks, but she continued to embarrass and confound her family until she died in 1972, and then again in 1973.
Okay, why? That's my big question. Why did she do this? Was this like a passing hobby, or did she actually try to make a living out of her pranking?
Late in her life, this was quite a question, and she was interviewed. This is where I got most of the information from, a magazine interview. And the interviewer put exactly that question to her after getting details of some of her merry pranks. And I said, why did you do it? And she said, oh, for a bit of fun. That was it. She made no money out of any of these things.
I can respect that.
And I think she just had that turn of mind where boring just wasn't good enough for her. She wanted to liven up society and culture, and she did it in pretty harmless ways.
Okay, so the harmless being the key word there, because with that sort of pranking, I always wonder about the possibility of things going wrong and that a prank ending up with, you know, someone getting injured.
You can hear the principal say, you've gone one step too far.
So she never went one step
far. She was never charged with anything. She never ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. And people came to respect her. They did enjoy her jolly japes.
Hmm. Oh, well, there you go. That I've got to say, this all has a ring of plausibility.
So that's my number one, George, that you're going to have to decide its veracity or not.
Well, as I said, it's got a ring of authenticity about it. There is, you know, a history of interest in pranking. So.
Of course, that's what we have to do. As writers,
indeed,
we have to get good at making the made-up sound true. So, time for your second story.
So we're going French or Australian?
French, please.
French. Okay. So we're going to Napoleon Bonaparte and the fact that he was once attacked by bunny rabbits.
Look, there's so many things about Napoleon's life. It's already sounding like it could be true.
Yes. Oh, well, I'm glad you think so. So this all happened in July 1807. So he had just recently signed the Treaties of Tilsit, which ended the war between the French Empire and Imperial Russia. And in celebration, he decided he wanted to hunt rabbits. So everything was left to his chief of staff, Alexandre Berthier,
That's convincing, George. That's convincing.
And so he arranged an outdoor luncheon, invited some of the military's biggest brass along, and collected a whole bunch of rabbits in cages around the outside of this field. The plan being to release the rabbits and then shoot the crap out of them, as you do. Now, there is a lot of haziness over this incident of the exact date and the exact number of rabbits, and reports vary from anywhere between, you know, hundreds of bunnies through to as many as 3,000 bunnies. I'm leaning towards the hundreds. I think the 3,000 is a lot of rabbits. But anyway, they released the rabbits. And much to everybody's surprise, the rabbits did not run away from the hunters, but in fact surged towards the hunters, and Napoleon in particular, because he was out the front. So I have an account of the incident here.
Oh, quotation time.
Yeah, quotation time. From General, he's got a really long name, General Paul Charles Francois Adrian Henri Dudon Thibault, who in his memoirs described the incident thus. The intrepid rabbits turned the emperor's flank, attacked him frantically in the rear, refused to quit their hold, piled themselves up between his legs till they made him stagger, and forced the conqueror of conquerors, fairly exhausted, to retreat and leave them in possession of the field. If you will excuse my French accent.
Oh, that's impressive.
Yes, and Napoleon had to flee and ended up in his carriage to escape the rabbits, and some of the rabbits apparently got into the carriage as well. Yeah, so there you have it.
The attack of the rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking, listening carefully, yes, we have come to do to each other's stories.
Mm-hmm.
I look for details that really sound true and really sound like, nah. Mm. And what was the name of the general and his memoir that you quoted?
General Paul Charles Francois Adrian Henri Dudonné Thibault, at least I assume that's how you pronounce it.
That's very convincing.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very
good. Gotta love a good long French name.
But of course you could have dropped that in order to gain
indeed
that level of...
Indeed.
I see. All right, so Napoleon and the rabbits.
There is a reason why the rabbits attacked him.
Tell me.
Yeah, and it all comes down to the chief of staff, who made a slight error in collecting these rabbits.
Uh-huh.
He didn't collect wild rabbits.
Mm.
He bought domesticated rabbits from farms.
Okay.
So wild rabbits would, of course, run because they're used to running away. Mm. Domestic rabbits, however, aren't used to running away.
Mm.
They see people coming towards them and they think, oh, they're going to feed us.
Ah, ah. Mm.
So basically you had a horde of hungry domesticated rabbits thinking they were about to be fed and going to demand their food.
All right, George, that is, all right, that one's, I've got to mull that one over, I think. Now, my next, I'm going ancient Greek history.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, way, way back here. Now, I'm talking about the death of Aeschylus. Now, Aeschylus was one of the great ancient Greek playwrights based in Athens. He was often called the father of tragedy, which is a really unfortunate nickname. Really. I would prefer to be known as the father of good stuff, but tragedy, yeah, what sort of a life are you charting for yourself once you adopt that nickname? Anyway, this was around about the 5th century BCE, so long, long time ago. Now, he, just for backgroundy stuff here, he wrote the Oresteia trilogy about the murder of King Agamemnon of Mycenae by his queen, Clytemnestra, and then because it was a trilogy, the next one went into the murder of Clytemnestra by her son, Orestes. And the third volume of this trilogy of plays was about the trial of Orestes and the end of the curse on the house of Atreus. So it's like a dynastic trilogy here, very, very famous. And the beginning of tragedy, where they set up a whole lot of the parameters for how tragedy actually works in theatre and literature generally. And thinking about this, the way that Agamemnon was murdered by his wife, and then she was murdered by her son, and why it hasn't been made into a major series on a quality streaming channel, I have no idea. It's just ripe for it. So he was a quality guy, very famous, well-respected, big figure in ancient Athens and in ancient Greece generally, because he did travel, which gets to the bottom of this. Because in around about 454 BCE, Aeschylus was in Sicily, visiting the city of Gelon, and he was killed outside the city by a tortoise, dropped by an eagle, which had apparently mistaken his bald head for a rock, perfect for cracking the shell. That's my ancient Greek fact, George.
I don't know if that's true, but I want it to be true because that's hilarious and tragic at the same time.
It is. It is tragic. It's just going about his business, not looking up, obviously. But apparently eagles in that part of the world had a habit of snatching up tortoises, looking for a nice rock, dropping them on the rock where the shell would crack, and then it's tortoise time.
One assumes he was stationary when this happened, because you don't get too many moving rocks.
That's a very good point. Those details were not in the ancient texts that I did consult.
This is the problem with really old stuff like this, is finding the detail, because often the detail isn't there.
No, that's right. It gives us room to manoeuvre. Story three.
All right, story three. We're going closer to home and a little bit more recent now with Australian history. Did you know that in 1933, Western Australia tried to secede from the Commonwealth and become its own country?
Uh-huh.
So there is a lot of background to this, because it wasn't just something that came out of the blue.
They didn't just wake up one morning and say,
It's pretty much right from word go, Western Australia was not overly thrilled about being part of the Commonwealth. So pretty much right from Federation, there was a West Australian secession movement who agitated for the state to become its own country. And things really worked up during the Great Depression. Economically, things weren't going well for Western Australia, and a lot of Western Australians felt that the federal government were making decisions that benefited other states rather than Western Australia, other states with more population, basically. So they felt very left out of things. So the whole secession movement gathered strength, and they petitioned the government, and this led to the Premier, James Mitchell, to legislate for a secession referendum in 1932. So the legislation was passed. and the referendum was set to take place on the 8th of April 1933, along with the state election of that year. So we had a turnout of 91.6% of registered voters, and 66.2% voted in favour of secession.
George, I guess stop you there.
Yes.
Statistics sound convincing.
Oh, they do, don't they?
They do.
Statistics make everything sound.
You've hit me there with numbers, with percentages. Yep. It's already sounding so true.
Sadly, James Mitchell did not get re-elected as Premier and got defeated by Philip Collier. But even though it was a different Premier, this Premier went along with the decision of the referendum and passed the Cessation Act of 1934, which basically authorised a delegation to be sent to the Parliament of the United Kingdom to petition for the cessation of Western Australia. Because, of course, the Australian Constitution was an act of British Parliament. Mm. So off they went, and basically British Parliament went, no, go away. And it never happened.
Now, George, this I keep hearing this sort of thing from West Australia every now and then, that they feel they should secede, they're not getting a fair deal, and they're neglected way over there on the west coast of Australia. So this 1933 sounds plausible, at least, that they wanted to secede way back then.
Mm.
Mm. So the truthiness of it is something for me to have to get into and really, really work this one out. Would they have voted in those sort of numbers? Surely they could see them. It sounds a bit like Scotland too, doesn't it? That they want to move away from the United Kingdom. Hmm. I mean, what's next? Norfolk Island will vote to secede to Northern Territory? All right, I will be thinking about that while I present my third piece, George. And I'm going into a bit of military history here.
Okay.
So we're talking World War II here. And this is Project Habakkuk. Bear with me.
Okay.
All right, so let me set the scene for you. Dark days. It's the dark days of 1942. The Nazis are romping across Europe. France, Belgium, and Denmark have fallen. Britain is looking across the Channel to the might of the Third Reich. So, Winston Churchill says, let's make a giant aircraft carrier out of an iceberg. The plan was to create what would have been the largest ever ship. It would have been 600 metres long, the length of 12 Olympic swimming pools, placed end to end. Or, if you prefer, 20 blue whales, placed nose to tail. Now, the title of the project, this top secret project, comes from the biblical book of Habakkuk.
I'd never heard of that one, actually.
I had never heard of the book of Habakkuk, but there it is. And it says in the King James Version, behold ye among the heathen, and regard, and wonder marvellously, for I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you.
Yeah, well, I'm not believing it so far. So
this is the idea that they needed aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers were being sunk by U-boats all over the place. A lot of British shipping was being sunk by submarines. Mm. So to combat this, they were going to either build an iceberg or renovate an existing iceberg.
Oh, hold on, how do you build an iceberg?
Yeah, with a giant refrigerator. Essentially, is doing that with seawater and refrigerant coils and so on. You would build it up. This is a brainchild of Geoffrey Pike, a British inventor. And he realised that ice needs just 1% of the energy needed to make steel. To make ice is so much cheaper, quicker, more efficient than making steel. Mm-hmm. So if you could make a lot of ice and it was useful, they were onto something. In development, though, there were problems with the ice.
Really?
Yeah.
Wouldn't have picked this.
So natural icebergs have too little above the surface. We know that. We've seen the pictures. There's so much of the iceberg below the surface, which wasn't terribly useful for landing planes on. And natural icebergs tip over really easily. That was the first hurdle. And this hurdle was surmounted when they invented pycrete. Pycrete was a mixture of water and wood pulp that, when frozen, was stronger than plain ice, as strong as steel, as slower melting, and would not sink. So pycrete was the next progression in this whole idea. So they abandoned the idea of using a natural iceberg, so they were going to build an iceberg out of this pycrete, and it would be huge. They made tests, they made scale models, mostly in Canada, because the north of Canada is nice and cold, and they could get cold lakes and start building this sort of scale model. But the project was abandoned because the full-sized vessel would cost more money and more machinery than a whole fleet of conventional aircraft carriers. But for a while there, the British Navy was going to have a gigantic iceberg aircraft carrier, Project Habakkuk.
Right. I'm a bit speechless on this one because it sounds so implausible.
The scale of it was tremendous. It was absolutely huge. And the idea was it would, as well as be very effective, because the thickness of the ice, you could fire torpedoes into it, you could drop bombs on it, and it would just laugh. And it would be very impressive too. It would daunt the Nazis, seeing this iceberg sailing towards them.
I could imagine that it would. What about summer? What about its longevity as a...
We do know that icebergs do float into the North Atlantic during the middle of summer. They are so big that you can lose quite a proportion of it through melting, and it just doesn't matter. Project Habakkuk. All right, do we want a quick review, George?
All right, so we had American history with Abe Lincoln, the pro wrestler.
Yeah, I'm still thinking Abominable Abe is the best moniker.
It is, isn't it? We've got French history with Napoleon and the bunnies.
Napoleon and the rabbits, yep.
And Australian history with West Australia's pursuit of independence.
Independent WA. All right, and I presented to you Glenda Pignall, the merry prankster who liked to dress up in bear suits. Then we had the death of Aeschylus, the ancient Greek playwright. And last of all was Project Habakkuk, the giant iceberg aircraft carrier. I think it's time to nail our colours to the mast, and we're going to have a guess.
All right.
Let me. So I'm thinking, George, that I'm narrowed down to Abe Lincoln, a wrestler. I can't come at that. But I can't come at Napoleon, the conqueror of Europe, being afraid of rabbits. So
he wasn't actually afraid of rabbits as such. Right. It's just that there were so many of them.
A tidal wave of rabbits. He wisely retired from the battleground.
Yeah, a strategic withdrawal.
Okay, so it was the event of Napoleon and the rabbits that you're claiming is true, but I am sceptical about. So I am going to say, nay, thumbs down to Napoleon and the rabbits.
Thumbs down to Napoleon and the rabbits. Well, I'm afraid that is actually a true occurrence. Napoleon did get inundated by rabbits. That general did write about it in his memoirs. The only uncertainty there is the number of rabbits.
They probably weren't able to count them all as they were scurrying about.
The cessation of Western Australia is also true.
Yeah.
They did endeavour to do
that. I can believe that.
The one that is untrue, and of course couched in truth, is Abe Lincoln, the pro wrestler, because Abe Lincoln actually was a wrestler. He did compete in 300 matches. However, he was a good wrestler, not a bad wrestler, as I've tried
to.
And he did, in fact, win all bar one match.
Well. So the fakery, the falsity of it was that he was bad.
Yes. So he was not a bad wrestler. He was a good wrestler, a damn fine wrestler, in fact.
Okay. Very neat. All right, George, do you want to have a guess at mine?
Oh, look, this is difficult because the prankster has the ring of truth about it. The playwright, I just so desperately want it to be true because it's just such a cool story. And the iceberg seems so damn improbable that it probably is true, because, you know, you wouldn't have hit me with something like so ridiculously improbable as your made up one. But I can't help myself. I've got to choose the iceberg, because I want the other two to be true.
So you're saying Project Habakkuk is fake?
Yeah.
George, I have to tell you that Project Habakkuk was true. Absolutely true. In World War II, the dark days, as we say, Winston Churchill seemed to have a penchant for outlandish schemes, really weird weapons, and he personally endorsed a number of these and gave budgets for them. Project Habakkuk was one of them.
Wow.
So
I am just astonished by that.
It's a great story. Go and have a look at it and find some more details. And the jaw just drops with every detail. The scale of the thing, the ambition of the inventor, the squabbles between the military and the engineers. It's, again, a movie waiting to happen.
Yeah, I'm surprised no one's actually picked up on this and done a novel or something.
The fake story that I presented to you was the biography of Glenda Pignall, the merry prankster. Oh. Totally made up, has no truth whatsoever. But I was thinking of some of those hoaxes and pranksters over the years, like Barry Humphreys, like Edgar Allan Poe in his early days was a renowned hoaxer.
Really? Poe was a hoaxer?
He wrote hoax stories and presented them in newspapers, caused mild panics around the place.
Oh, wow.
And then he must have had some sort of a life incident and decided to write really morbid and dark stuff afterwards. But so I do like those people. I think they add a little bit of variety to society in our lives.
Indeed.
And Aeschylus, absolutely true, or at least as true as anything 2,500 years is. It's reported in a number of sources, so that tends to add a bit of truth to it rather than, it's a story someone made up. So independent people have said, Aeschylus died by having a tortoise dropped on his head by an eagle.
I'm so pleased by that.
What a way to go.
It is such a theatrical way to go.
True.
For someone who wrote tragedies.
True. That's all, folks. Bonk. And away we go. Well, I think it's time to wind up this episode, George. And it's been another cracker of an episode of It's True or Is It?
I have loved learning all these wonderful things about history.
And we hope everybody out there have gone along for the ride. And I wonder which one you chose out there as the fake from each of us. So I think it's time to say goodbye to you all until next episode. My name is Michael Pryor.
Mine is George Ivanov.
And until next time, bye. And that was the It's True or Is It podcast with Michael Pryor and George Ivanov. If you want to know more about Michael's books, podcasts and other projects, go to www.michaelpryor.com.au. And for George's books, writing and other projects, pop over to georgeivanov.com.au. Now, we'll be back next time with more amazing facts, more amazing falsities, and remember, it's true or is it? This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture.